Hello and welcome to Your Best Self, a podcast about careers. I'm your host, Faye Rowlands, lawyer and journalist, and together in this podcast, we'll hear from inspirational people spanning the worlds of business, politics, law, media, science, art, and more, sharing what they love most about their jobs, how they handle setbacks, and offer listeners their tips to career success. I hope this podcast informs and inspires you to think big and encourages you to go after the dream job you want. Well, this day 35 years ago, an accident at a nuclear reactor in Chernobyl unleashed radiation 200 times greater than the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. Over 400,000 people were forced to evacuate their homes in what would become one of the world's worst nuclear disasters in living memory. My guest this week has made it her life's mission to help survivors and those left behind in the wake of the Chernobyl disaster. She's researched and produced award-winning documentaries which unveiled the true scale of the Chernobyl tragedy to the world. She's received numerous awards in recognition of her activism and dedication to humanity. And 5 years ago, she was extended an invitation to address the UN General Assembly in New York. Following this landmark address, the United Nations resolved to mark today, April 26th, an International Day of Commemoration to honour those whose lives were affected by the Chernobyl nuclear tragedy. I'm of course referring to the one and only Adi Roach. In this episode, we speak about finding hope in the midst of tragedy, how her charitable organisation has coped during the pandemic, and the new pastime that has given her a new lease of life. 40 years on, and Adi's passion for her work is as infectious as ever. And I just know you'll really enjoy what she has to say in this episode. Adi, thank you so much for speaking with me today on the podcast.
My pleasure, Faye. My pleasure. Really, it is. I'm looking forward to this.
Me too. Well, Adi, we all know you, of course, as this humanitarian, as an activist on environmental issues, on issues relating to social justice. But I'd be very curious, Adi, to hear a little bit about your childhood experience growing up in Tipperary and how your upbringing helped shape your view of the world.
My parents were, now we'd call them today social activists, but we didn't have that language back then. But my parents were very active. And because I was the youngest, I kind of tended to be dragged along to everything that they were doing. And I suppose the joy, the love and the hope that I feel comes from watching them and engaging with them in a very small way. I began to see that I too could make a very small little difference in the impact of people's lives. For example, they worked with the travelling community. So I would often been visiting actually campsites as they were then, because they were very much more nomadic than now, or visiting settled families. Meals on Wheels was another one. And also through the Vincent de Paul. And I think I saw very early that, like, actually I lived in a bit of a bubble where we lived as a family. And that was very different. Like 5 minutes down the road, I really saw deprivation, abject poverty, people that didn't have food on the table, coal in the fire. And I learned very early, without knowing the words of injustice or inequality, I saw through my own eyes that, you know, things weren't well for everybody. So I suppose the seeds were sown during that time, what would I suppose develop as a social conscience to myself. But in 1977, the Irish government decided that they wanted to build a nuclear power station. In fact, actually not one, but four nuclear power stations in what now is, of course, a beauty spot in Wexford, in Carnsore Point. This was the place. And I remember saying, my God, like, what is nuclear power? I didn't even know. And then there had been an accident in a place called Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in Three Mile Island nuclear station. And my brother was actually living there at the time. And I remember I just got married in 1977. And I remember turning to my husband, Sean, saying to him, my God, like, what does that mean? So I kind of learned through that kind of family experience that this was something dangerous that could happen. Sean and I got very actively involved in the what was then called the anti-nuclear movement. And we went down to Carnsore Point with Christy Moore, who mortgaged his house to pay for the first anti-nuclear rally. We had actually a national movement. And that really, I suppose, was the beginning of my own flourishing in a different way. I heard speakers like Petra Kelly, who was the founder of the Green Party and the Green Movement in Germany. She was a member of the European Parliament. And while I didn't understand a lot of what she spoke about in terms of the politics of things, she spoke very deeply to something in my heart, that kicked back to the memory of being a youngster and watching the first landing on the moon and my father explaining to me about, you know, how fragile and beautiful our Earth is. And I remember when Petra Kelly spoke about how endangered our life had become because of the development of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. I then began to see that perhaps this was something that, you know, that I had something to offer. And I mean, that was the start in 1977. This was in the height really of a time, it was known as the Cold War historically, when East and West were literally saber rattling at each other's throats and threatening to go to nuclear war. So when that threat came, like, I did get involved from Carnsore Point, sort of in the movement to stop the building, the development and the potential use of nuclear weapons in our world. And Ireland, as a small neutral country, had a great kind of a little power base. Like, we were a small island nation. We had no nuclear weapons. We had no nuclear power at that stage. And so that we kind of could have a strong voice and be kind of the candle of hope for other countries in moving towards a world of disarmament and moving towards development. When we successfully lobbied the Irish government to reverse their decision to go nuclear, and I often remember saying, you know, we're doing this for future generations, like for the children that have yet to be born in Ireland, so that they can inherit a nuclear-free future. And in the middle of that, then the Chernobyl accident actually happened in 1986. So in a sense, everything I had done until that point really, I suppose, was all about the preparation for this point, because I knew the theory of what could happen from the school days of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, from the dropping of those bombs, and then to the fear of nuclear war during the Cold War. And when 86 came, I just kind of felt, this is it in reality. I have the theory. So what's the reality? So myself and a group of doctors, we put together, information for those people who were really, really fearful, like young families were fearful for their children, pregnant women, teachers for their students, etc. Then there was radio silence, because again, we were under the thumb of the Soviet Union. And finally, thanks be to God, something got through in late 1990, early 1991. We got a fax message into our office which said just two lines: SOS appeal, for God's sake, help us to get the children out. And that was to get the children out of radiation zones, children who were sleeping, eating and breathing in this world's most toxic environment.
And Adi, was that the catalyst? Was receiving that message for you a call to action? Was that the catalyst that you know, put this idea in your head of launching this organization and making this your life's work?
Well, it was absolutely, Faye, the catalyst, the receiving that fax, because it was like, just, you know, you can't turn your back on this. This is the reality. These are the doctors that took great personal risk of imprisonment, risk of disappearing, for giving us the information that all was not well. But I have to say, Faye, we actually didn't really realise the true impact of it. Like, I responded from the heart, because I'm very heart driven, and we didn't actually have a plan of what we were going to do. And in a lot of ways, I say thanks be to God, I didn't have a life plan, because if I had known then what would be required for the following 35 years, I probably would have run a mile in the opposite direction, because I would have said, one, I don't have the qualifications, I don't have the capacity, I didn't have the confidence, or anything. I wouldn't have known where to start. So in a way, it's good sometimes to just follow your gut and follow your instinct. And I followed that fax message religiously and organized for the first group of Chernobyl children to come into Ireland for rest and recuperation.
And Aidy, before we get into that, can you just describe for us what your first visit to Chernobyl was like?
It was a very monochrome society. Everything was very grey, very dark, very dull. It was the middle of winter. It was minus 24 degrees. And I held a Geiger counter, which measures radioactivity, in my hand the whole time we were there. And like, we kept on hearing this sound, this like alarm bell ringing all the time, which was an alert to us that we were in, you know, in danger with the radioactivity. I remember going into the what we now call the exclusion zone, the deserted villages. 2,000 towns and villages became deserted and people became environmental refugees. What was left behind were these empty streets, like seeing washing hanging on the line, seeing children's toys, you know, strewn in a garden. And I was just sort of just horrified, really, because the radiation by its nature is invisible. You can't see it, taste it or touch it. And the only way we were able to see it was through this kind of emptiness.
And Aidy, do you think that the rest of the world at that stage knew the full extent of the fallout of this disaster?
The world knew nothing. We were blissfully unaware until that very first visit in 1990. And like, one of the things that I felt we had to do once I had gone and I had witnessed, I felt compelled to try and tell the story of the true impact of the tragedy to the world. So we used the medium of documentary making. Now, I had no history in filmmaking. I had no history in research or anything like that. But again, ignorance is bliss. You learn as you go. And eventually I managed to get someone to sponsor the making of what became the world's first documentary on Chernobyl. And I got Ali Hewson, who's still a beloved and dear friend and also a member of our board of directors. Ali became the presenter of the documentary and I did the research on it. And actually, you know, that was the first telling of the story to world eyes. And from then until now, like, you know, I've spent a lot of time either writing about it, researching about it, or you know, I'm making documentaries, because I think there's nothing more powerful actually than, you know, the image. And when you're dealing with something, I mean, Faye, the hardest thing to get across to anybody in all of these decades that have passed is that, you know, it is like a war in that, you know, it was caused by man, the devastation, the destruction, but the similarities end when it comes to the solution. There is a beginning, middle and an end to a famine, thank God, to a war and to, you know, to anything else that's going on in the world. But when it comes to this war, this invisible enemy is radiation, there was no standing army that they could send. There was no antidote. There was no safe haven, no enclave where you could take your most vulnerable. It literally permeated every aspect of the cycle of life, including the very DNA of life itself.
And Aidy, how do you find hope amid all of that devastation and all of that tragedy? How do you find hope?
I think that, you know, the power of one, that we can make a difference, you know, and I really believe the power of intervention. And that while I am not a qualified doctor, I am not a scientist, but I know that I have love in my heart and I have a willing pair of hands and a big heart. And I just hope through the power of intervention that we can make a difference. And I see that every day in our work, whether it's the implementation of cardiac programs, hospice programs. And really, I suppose, you know, there's nothing altruistic about why I have been doing this for an awful long time. It really is as much about trying to find meaning in my own life and to try and keep that ember of hope fanned alive, sort of even within myself, because I think we have a great capacity as a people and as a nation to do great things. And I think maybe it spans back to our own history, going back to the time of the Great Irish Famine, when, you know, our own population was halved through enforced starvation and mass emigration. And we survived as a race purely because of intervention that came from North America and from others who sent shipments of grain and corn into Dublin, Cork, Galway, Waterford. And like somewhere deep within all of us Irish citizens is what we term sometimes, you know, a race memory, that we know what it is like as a people to have suffered. And therefore, now that we can, that like we're a wealthy nation and that, you know, that like things are good in our lives, that we have the capacity to throw a lifeline to people that all around the world. I think Irish people are known very much for, you know, sort of, I suppose, having a passion for life and an ability to transform that into our compassion for humanity. And that, I suppose, is what sustains me.
And by the time that this podcast is released, it will be 35 years since the disaster. I mean, what has changed in that time? Does Chernobyl still pose a threat to this day?
Absolutely. 35 years later, well, certainly I can say that a lot of things have improved kind of economically and socially for the people in these countries. And, you know, and if some improvement hadn't happened after international intervention, I give up. Those that were children in 1986 are the young parents of 2021. And it's in that generation again, we're seeing what's called now Chernobyl lineage, where it passes from one generation to another to another. So we're actually onto the third generation of Chernobyl survivors. So therefore, we now recognize that, you know, that this, like Chernobyl may sound like reading history for your generation, Faye, but the reality is Chernobyl is forever. You know, it's not a past event because it's locked in the DNA of human beings, flora, fauna, animal life, etc. And there is a latency period for an awful lot of the cancers to emerge for up to 6 decades. So we're nowhere near seeing the peak of this because this takes a long time to move through the genetics.
Well, that's interesting, Adi, because I was going to ask you, I suppose, what happened in 1986 with Chernobyl, I suppose that was a lesson or a warning to the rest of the world about the dangers of nuclear power. Do you think that we have heeded that warning?
You know, Chernobyl has acted as a cautionary tale, and it warrants us to closely examine how it is we produce our energy in order to put on our light bulbs and run our laptops and Zoom calls and everything else. And I am a fervent believer, because of what I have seen and what I know and what I have learned and what I have heard, I'm a firm believer in the pathway of renewable energy, sustainable energy development. And I would love to see more investment in that direction. We need to focus our energy on alternative sources of energy and really looking at things like Chernobyl as something that act as a message, I suppose, really for future generations. And that's why I was so happy when we saw last year the Chernobyl story being retold in a whole new way through the HBO Sky miniseries, just boldly called one word, Chernobyl. And that retold it to my generation and told it anew to your generation, Faye, told the story with fresh eyes, with a fresh heart, with fresh, with fresh knowledge. And they showed this in a way never articulated or voiced before. And they were meticulous in how they researched it, down to the last detail.
And Adi, that brings me to the point. I understand that the Irish actress Jessie Buckley involved in that production, she came to you for assistance in preparing for that role. How did that come about and how did you help her prepare for that role?
Oh, well, listen, what a great honour that was. I've actually been a fan of Jessie Buckley ever before she got this part. And now we've become really great friends. Jessie wanted to kind of immerse herself in what is it like. Well, the book that the series is based on is written by a friend of mine. The book is, the woman is called Svetlana Alexievich. She's a Nobel laureate for literature, and included in that body of work to get the Nobel Prize was her book on Chernobyl called Chernobyl Voices, or Voices from Chernobyl. And the book is based on these eyewitness accounts, this truth-telling book. So they knew I had a connection with Svetlana. And then, well, because Jessie knew, of course, like every family in Ireland in some shape or form has been involved with Chernobyl, either fundraising or hosting kids. And she just got in touch by email, and I phoned her. She was working in London at the time, and she was, the whole thing was actually starting up. So I started to prepare because I knew the story so well of the woman and the woman's husband that she was going to be representing. So I kind of, I suppose, gave her the look and the feel and the sensitivity, having spoken to all of these people myself. And I was able to tell her sort of at a soulful level what it was like for these people to lose absolutely everything and then to be forgotten by the rest of the world. And then they started to ask me about the authenticity of the production and how things were looking and feeling. So they would send me, parts of the footage and send me different things. And how does this look and feel? Does that look like what it was like way back then? And I can tell you, they were meticulous in how they researched it. But what was, you know what it did? It unmasked the lies, the deception, and it unraveled the mystery of Chernobyl and told it with an honest and a brave and courageous voice. It gave voice, finally, to those people that are, to me, our heroes, the liquidators, the men, 800,000 of whom were conscripted in to try and make Chernobyl safe because there was a risk of a second massive explosion happening. And these guys were known as the liquidators. And the film was very much telling their story. And these men self-sacrificed in order to save the rest of the world. 45,000 of them died, like in the couple of years afterwards. And, so it was great that they actually told afresh that story that had been relegated to the realms of history.
Adi, I'd like to talk to you now about the impact of COVID. Obviously, we all know the pandemic has had a very adverse effect for the charitable sector, and I suppose in particular your own organisation, because access has been impeded, your people on the ground, being able to deliver medical supplies. You know, what fears would you have about the longer term impact that would have on your charity and its mission?
Yeah, that's actually a very sobering kind of question. And, you know, there's a huge part of me, to be honest, Faye, that I actually don't even want to think about it. Because, you know, sometimes when you're fearful of something, you know, your automatic response is to kind of shut it down. And I certainly did a lot of that when we went into lockdown for the first time, which we thought was going to be the only time, last March, because literally overnight, our income dropped by something like 90%. Like, our phone stopped ringing, the email stopped, the research, the queries coming in from people, the requests for speaking engagements, everything came to a grinding halt. And I remember sort of being in shock, registering shock actually in the early days, and wondering how was I going to keep the organization alive? First of all, how was I going to keep it alive here? And all of the thousands of, or as I call them, our foot soldiers, our army of people, our nurses, our doctors, our physiotherapists, our plumbers, our carpenters, tilers, our host families. How would I keep them all engaged when everybody was kind of living in fear for themselves and their families and communities? And how was I going to keep the motivation going? And then on the other hand, I had, how were we going to keep the services running?
And Adi, can I ask you, actually, what was the response from the Belarusian government to COVID-19? What has their response been?
Well, I have to say it verged, I suppose, on being bizarre in the beginning. It was, shall we say, very different and pretty much out of step with what the rest of the world was doing and how we were reacting. because obviously there was huge denial about it in the early days, and that did cause like a major problem, because in April last year we had a huge outbreak of COVID-19 in an institution where we do an awful lot of pioneering work. So we kind of were seeing firsthand what was actually happening. But now things like they're getting the vaccine now, and there is acknowledgement that the virus exists. But for us, one of the hardest things was that, like, we had to stop dead. Like, we sent out multidisciplinary teams every single month, teams of nurses and physios and speech therapists and general volunteers. They go out to work in institutions in a program. All of that stopped dead. And we, you know, so that was finished. Then, I would go regularly myself, I'm doing a lot of sort of negotiations at the moment in the sphere of legislation, regulation, implementation of the UN Convention for the Rights of People with Disabilities, the UN Convention for the Rights of the Child, all of these things to get like drop down implementation at a regulation level, because they've signed up to the conventions, but that's only when the work really begins. So I can't get over for those meetings. Also, I miss so much the human contact with the children, because in a sense, you know, like we are, that's what kind of drives the organization, you know, are the beautiful faces of these fragile and vulnerable children, and they're what it's all about. So there is a personal loss there, Faye, that we're missing, but we're starting to wind up again. We are hoping, once we're all vaccinated, that we're planning on getting a cardiac surgical mission into Ukraine to do life-saving surgeries towards the end of April. We are planning on going over ourselves back to the teams, going every month, and I'll be in one of those teams, maybe in October. And we are hoping that by Christmas we will be able to bring the children back for rest and recuperation. And Faye, if we have learned anything from Chernobyl, it is this, that our earth is a fragile thing that has become a beautiful, I suppose, grain of life in the depths of the universe that has become so fragile in the hands of man. And I suppose, you know, part of my drive is to ensure that we protect it for future generations, that we are the custodians, we are the caretakers, because, you know, we don't own this planet. We are here to protect it for future generations. And that, I suppose, really is the guiding kind of vision or philosophy for the organization, is the recognition of the beautiful gift that we have inherited from the generations that went before us.
And Ada, you mentioned the work there that your organization has been doing closely with UN. I know you yourself have addressed the UN General Assembly on several occasions. Were you ever tempted to go into politics yourself, or do you feel that you can effect greater change, you know, with the work that you're doing with your organization?
One of the greatest moments of my life really was the opportunity to speak to the General Assembly, because that isn't a kind of a normal thing for just an ordinary citizen to do, someone that doesn't come from any special background, somebody who is not a politician or a diplomat. And yet they wavered their own rules and regulations to give me that privilege. And what fell out of that was just extraordinary. What happened the following year was the UN decided that this day needed to be honoured and marked. And for the rest of time, beyond my life, your life, for the rest of time, the United Nations have a designated day, the day of the anniversary, the 26th of April, each and every year, as a day of remembering of what happened, and saying to today's and to tomorrow's, you know, Chernobyl victims, that they are not forgotten. To be honest, looking at my own history, I'm a grassroots person. I'm a movement person. I am an activist. I'm like a roll up the sleeves, hands on person. So for me, I probably wouldn't have been able to really sit well in the confines of politics. But that said, I did go forward in 1997 for the presidency of Ireland, which was an honour and a privilege in itself. But really, honestly, Faye, for me, I feel I can do far more on the outside, because it means I'm not aligned to anybody. I've never been a member of a political party, and I have no intention of this hour of my life joining one either. So it means I can be everybody's friend, right, left and centre, because I don't have a vested interest other than the protection of life on the planet. And it means then that you can talk to whoever is in power. I don't mind, because I will go and find, you know, the ears that will potentially listen to the message. And I have to say, there is huge right across the political divide in Ireland. There is huge support for the work that we do. And the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, is a great supporter of our work and has been down through the years. And in fact, he launched my very first book on Chernobyl. And I think that was about maybe, I don't know, 25 years or 20 years ago, but and has remained a great friend. I love people. And, you know, that's the hardest thing about being in lockdowns, is not being able to connect with people. But, you know, so I think I can be far more effective at doing what I'm doing.
And AD, I suppose anybody who's achieved anything of note or any degree of success, I suppose everybody has faced setbacks and disappointments along the way. And I was just wondering, what would you say you've learned about yourself, or what has made you stronger from some of the disappointments that maybe you've experienced, or difficulties? I mean, you mentioned there, obviously, the difficulties posed by COVID with your organization. What is it that motivates you to keep going during difficult times?
I suppose I always focus on, we have to find ways and means. We have to, you know, nothing is ever on a straight line. You know, there are twists and turns, and sometimes you're in a labyrinth and you can't even find the way out. You can't even get to the center of something. But I always, you know, believe in the old dictum of, where there's a will, there's a way. And is always trying to focus on the positive, to emphasize the positive, to find the hope in everything that I do, because otherwise we would be so disempowered that, you know, I'd want to keep my head in the sand. I always want to think that there is a solution, no matter what has been thrown our way. I would be tenacious, I suppose. I found that I would, I don't give up that easily. If I'm on the trail of something, and I never take no for an answer. I'll find another way of getting around and coming around to something, or waiting in the wings for another opportunity. And I'll just keep coming back to the same thing until people just kind of say, oh, I give in. What is it you're looking for? So I suppose it's always trying to find the positive in everything. And I think my experience in the work of the charity is that really everybody has compassion in them. Everybody feels the bond to, you know, our shared common human family. And, you know, everybody wants to support in some way. And, you know, like, I always kind of tap in on that, like on that shared kind of common humanity, that global family that we are. I often say to people, you know, we throw this umbilical cord out to the world. You know, for me, it's to the victims and survivors of Chernobyl. And like, it is our privilege, actually, and it is our honor to be able to enter the life of another human being, and to be able to in some way influence or change or improve. Because in that giving, you receive a thousandfold what you put in. And that's actually kind of what's so special.
And AD, you've been working at a ferocious pace for over 30 years now, I suppose, up until, you know, COVID, as I suppose, you know, paused things, put the pause button on things for a little bit. But your passion is still as strong as ever, clearly. Looking to the future, you know, would you like to retire in the future, or are you keen to keep going with this mission?
Do you know what? It depends on the day of the week that you ask me that about retiring. I mean, I would say, first of all, ask my sister or ask my husband, because they just throw their eyes up to heaven when it comes to retirement. Like, I'm actually 66 this year. And like, one would say I'm past my sell by date. But do you know what? You know, age is only a number. I'm as fit as a fiddle. I have huge energy and passion for everything. And I'm just going to keep going, you know, until something goes out in me. If the light is extinguished, if I feel you know, there's nothing left for me to do, well, then, you know, maybe I'll consider it. But I certainly will take things lighter. How about that? Like, I have worked at a mile a minute, you know, 24/7, 7 days a week until the lockdowns put manners on me, I can tell you. I have never been at home for a prolonged period of time until COVID last March. And that was a challenge in itself. I always lived out of a suitcase. There was always a suitcase packed under the bed in the house because I knew I was going to be going somewhere, either abroad or somewhere around Ireland. And the suitcase hasn't been touched for a year, which is really weird. But so as long as I still have the passion and as long as I have the hope, you know, I'm going to keep going. As long as they'll have me.
I'm sure they will. Your passion is infectious, clearly, and you've achieved so much. But I suppose you spent so much of your life's work helping others. I'd be curious to know, what do you like to do that's just for you?
Oh, well, I have a few passions. I absolutely love singing. And I'm in a singing group with some girlfriends for about the last, blah, 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 how many years, maybe 35 years. And, you know, we sing a cappella generally, and we sing, you know, in different harmonies. And my husband is a musician, so he does the arranging and sometimes he accompanies us if we're not singing a cappella. But actually, I have rediscovered a passion I had when I was a teenager. I'm from the banks of the River Shore in Clonmel, County Tipperary. And the only way to meet members of the opposite sex in those days was to join a club. So I joined our local rowing club called The Island, because it was a little physical island actually in the middle of the river, would you believe? You had to go across a bridge and everything to get to it. And I loved rowing during my teenage years from about 12 to maybe 17 or 18 until I went to Dublin and joined Aer Lingus. And I went back to rowing, would you believe this? I went back to rowing 3 years ago. I'm not good at maths now, so I'm not sure how many years lapsed, but it was something like 43 or 46 years since I had sat into a boat. And I'm now the oldest female rower in Cork. And I row with a group of women. We're called Lady Masters, and we row competitively because I'm actually quite competitive. And I love it for the pleasure. I actually, I live in a place that's just overlooking the River Lee here, and it's just so beautiful. And when Sean and I downsized to here 3 years ago, I used to look wistfully at the river saying, wouldn't I love to row, but I'm too old. And then I met someone and said, you're never too old. But of course, techniques had changed, or my muscles had gone somewhere else, or they were half dead. So I had a lot of training to do and to catch up. And I am with a brilliant squad of women, and we train like crazy. Even when we can't get on the water, we do. I do weightlifting, we do core training, and we're hoping to go back on the water in competition in April of this year, April or May of this year.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I absolutely love it. And you know, people will say, "Well, you know, are you sure that you can do it? Like at your age." I'll say, you know, I mean, really, it really is all in the mind. A lot of these things, you know, if you think you're old, well, then you're old. I've met some old 21-year-olds. You know, it depends on where you are in your mind and in your psychology and, you know, what is your view of the world, I suppose. So they're the things I do, like in between saving the world.
82 last questions for you. So as we record this now, we've just passed International Women's Day. And I was just wondering, who has influenced you in your career?
Now you'd need a long list for this, but a number, like in terms of history, Countess Markievicz, definitely. I would say Petra Kelly, that I mentioned, the founder of the Green Party. I would mention the suffragette movement, a very powerful influence in our lives. And I would say on the male side, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, because I learned so much from all of these different people, and they would be sort of my mentors and my role models.
Amazing. And then, Adie, if you were to offer some advice to your younger self starting out now, what advice would you give?
Well, I suppose I would say dream your dreams, follow your heart, follow your vision, and don't forget to give a helping hand to those who need it.
Amazing. No, that's brilliant advice. Such a pleasure speaking with you on the podcast today, Aidy.
Thank you, Faye. Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to make a contribution to the work of Chernobyl Children's International or learn more about what they do, you can visit their website, chernobyl-international.com/donate. Thanks for listening to Your Best Self. If you enjoyed this podcast, please hit the subscribe button or leave me a review.